So I'd like to take a period of time now before lunch where we can explore what the goal of practice is, or what the what your aspiration is for undertaking this practice, and within the discussion I'd like to know what the role of technique is within the role, or within the, what's the role of technique in the, in fulfilling your aspiration. So for some reason you've all come here this weekend. What's that? Why? Why this weekend? Why this practice? Why is this valuable to you? What is it that you hope to get? What is it that you are getting? What is it that you have gotten in the past and are either satisfied with or want more of? Because all of these judgments, evaluations, or assumptions in the mind affect how we're going to practice here this morning and this afternoon. And if we can see which of those assumptions and beliefs and experiences are skillful and useful, then we can acknowledge them. And if we can acknowledge what are unskillful, then we can find a way to put them aside or to let go of them. Let me just give you an example. When I first started meditation practice, and I know some of you are new to practice, so this might be, I really didn't have any idea what I was doing. I was mostly into, well, drugs. And I thought it was something like that. I thought that somehow there was supposed to be some sort of kind of peculiar, you know, dramatic would be good, distinctive, otherworldly almost, kind of experience. Well, and so that was just an assumption. That was just a belief that I didn't even know I had, but now in retrospect I realize that, that there was some kind of thought that, that, that meditation practice was really otherworldly, or at least as distorting as drugs could be, or were at the time. And of course, mostly what I experienced was knee pain and back pain, and I thought I wasn't doing it right, and tormented myself for 10 years like that, struggling to get rid of the pain in the body and the restless mind and all the judgment I had, so that I could finally get to this other world of meditative bliss or something. And I struggled for a long time, just really, you know, just trying to do something, using the techniques that, that my very skillful teachers offered me, you know, attending to the breath and noting and all those things, using those techniques. But underneath it, underneath the skillfulness of those techniques, and they can be very skillful, was this underlying assumption that I didn't see, and goal that I didn't acknowledge. Well, if I can save any of you from 10 years of struggling like that, but on the other hand, maybe we have to do 10 years of struggle before we finally get it. So, what's going on for you? What's your assumptions about practice? So where do you think, what do you think you're supposed to be experiencing, or what do you think yours could get from your practice? And I know it's kind of a big group and you might feel a little shy, but just like my experience maybe seems peculiar and unique and distinctive to me, I know that many of you in the room have the same kind of experience. So whatever any one person says often is speaking for many other people in the room too. So those of you who have the courage or the whatever it is to speak, then please What's up? You've met your goals, and you don't know what to do for the next set of goals.
When I first began, I had a lot of difficulty with right speech, kindness, and I still struggle with that, of course. Mm-hmm. I'm careful, but I do have time to be able to make a choice about what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
And so that has come to pretty much to fruition. I've suffered a great deal when I first began.
Yes.
I'm happy now. I don't have a great deal of suffering. It's still the usual.
Okay, so what Charlotte is saying is that the major suffering of deep depression has been let go of, and now she just has ordinary human suffering, you know, the daily grind of suffering, and wondering, and I think that's a good way to put it, you know, the kind of the crisis level of suffering gets handled, and then we're just kind of into ordinary life suffering, and now what's our next goal? You know, and is there is this practice effective in addressing that? That's kind of the yeah. I'm going to take a couple more comments, yeah, and then I'm going to speak to it. Yeah, please. No, I'm going to hear what you say and a couple others, then I'm going to say something. Yeah. Yes. So, what's your name?
Lynn.
She's acknowledging that she's looking for the development of mind to the strengthening of mind so that she can endure holding painful experience. Mm-hmm. Now, let me just clarify. When you say to hold painful experience, what does that mean for you? So,
I want to be able to be present in the moment.
Right.
With unpleasant.
Okay, so what she's saying is when painful experience becomes apparent, that she just zones out and spaces out and distracts herself, just can't really stay present with painful experience. And that you have the hope that through meditation practice, you can strengthen the mind to be able to hold or to experience pain more steadily, more consciously. Yeah. Yeah.
I've been noticing, especially since last summer, that, and it's not so much when I'm meditating, but outside, that I'm noticing more of a space around whatever reaction that I would ordinarily just kind of jump into.
Mm.
So it's like there's just this space in between. It's almost like the observing whatever it is that's coming up, and it's just giving me a little bit more time to make a choice on how I want to respond depending on on whatever it is.
Yeah. I wanna kind of pick up on what Charlotte and I'll get to that one, Charlotte and Lynn said. because I think that at different times for all of us, we do find ourselves entangled in a really intense emotional, it can be depression, it can be some other painful emotionally painful experience, and it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming in the sense that we can't, we just distract ourselves, or we act out our anger about it, or our frustration with it, or we internalize it and get depressed. And what awareness training or mindfulness training asks us to do is to just acknowledge that. And it requires, as you all know, that we kind of see the truth, that we actually can acknowledge to ourselves, I'm feeling depressed, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling jealous, I'm feeling, you know, emotional pain of some sort. And in the very process of opening to what is going on in the moment, because that's what's going on in the moment, in the very process of opening to it, we do cultivate these wholesome qualities of mind, like steadiness of mind, so that we can gradually learn to stabilize the mind in even very painful situations, or very fearful, or an internalized aversion like depression. We can learn to stabilize. But one of the challenges for all of us in cultivating these qualities of mind is that, so in the beginning of practice, it's easy to get overwhelmed. It's common, you know, that when we start mindfulness practice, we can get easily overwhelmed with unpleasant or very difficult emotional states. We also very easily get overwhelmed with very pleasant, excited mental states. I'm going to just mention what you mentioned in the... And one fellow was saying that when he sits down, he just goes into another world, and it's great. You know, it's just kind of like, wow, bliss or whatever. It's just like nothing bad happening, and, you know, comes out of meditation, and it's fine. Just, what's wrong with that? You know, and he asked one of our collaborating teachers, Sharon, you know, what's going on? And she said, you're wasting your time. Oh, well, okay. But what both that experience and your experience points to is that in the beginning of practice, the mind is very unstable. It's very weak. Very weak. It cannot open to and hold, as you say, or experience deeply either pleasant or unpleasant experience. It gets seduced by the pleasant, and it gets averse to the unpleasant. And this is just the way it is. And to want to be free of that, of course, when you see the suffering, it's easy to see the suffering of the unpleasantness. It's more difficult to see the suffering of the indulgence in that pleasantness. It's suffering, but we don't see it. It's more difficult to see it. So I think having the understanding that development of awareness is let me be quite honest with you, it's a lifetime process. It's a lifetime process. It's not something you get done on a weekend or in a decade or two, or, you know, it is going to be an ongoing practice for the rest of your lives, plural. And sometimes just kind of getting a glimpse of how what that requires can be both supportive. It's like, oh, this is just something we do. This is just life becomes awareness practice, rather than it's something you get, and then once you got it, then you're off the hook, so to speak. That can change your, you know, how you understand practice can change how you approach this sitting, this next period of time. If you understand that this is something you're going to be doing for the rest of your life, okay, relax. Just relax. The way it is the way it is. Okay. If you think that, oh, there's something I'm going to get this weekend and that's going to really change my life, well, that's true. It is. You know, whatever you get this weekend will change your life. But not that dramatically. And so if you have this kind of striving attitude, I'm really, you know, I'm going to get it this year because, God, I'm going to get married next year and I better have it together before then, you know, or something. You know, it's like a degree. I'm going to get my degree before I get my career. Well, if you have an assumption or if you have a belief that there's something really to get, it is both right and wrong. There is something to get. If you struggle to get it, it'll really be an impediment to your practice. But gradually, I just want to say gradually, in spite of our worst efforts or our best intentions, we will get through the challenging, the most overwhelming emotional stuff. And it's just through practice. It's just through learning to steady the mind on this moment's experience. And that's what cultivates and strengthens the qualities of mind, of awareness, attention, intention, energy, understanding, faith, equanimity. All of these qualities of mind get cultivated in just trying to be present with this moment's experience. So it's a gradual thing. It'll come. Yeah.
Hey, I have a question. So I've been working at this for quite a while. Now,
you've been working at meditation for quite a while?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's this thing in our head called the mind or the brain, however you want to call it.
Okay. There's a thing in our head called the brain or the mind.
Everything is focused on getting it to work differently than it works. Because if it worked fine the way it was, no one would be meditating.
Okay, so you're thinking that the effort of meditation is to get it to work differently than it does.
Yeah, because it's not working the way we want it.
Okay.
We're experiencing suffering and we're experiencing all these things.
Okay.
And if it was working some other way, then
it'd be fine. Yeah. It'd be over. We'd be done meditating.
Our surgeons could go in there, make a few little, you know, lesions here and a few little lesions there.
Yeah.
And their ruminations would go away. Attachment would go away. All these things would just go away.
Ah.
Would that be the same as being enlightened?
Would that be the same as being enlightened? I think that'd be more like having a lobotomy. I want to.
It's all about the mind. It isn't about the liver or the kidneys or our arms or our legs or anything. It's just about this thing in between our ears.
Well, now, isn't that an interesting comment? The mind is located between the ears, right? Where do you feel love? In the mind? Up in the head? Or do you feel love?
No, but we don't feel pain in the head. We don't feel hardly anything.
Okay, where do let me offer you another option.
Yeah.
What if meditation isn't about changing the way the mind works, but it's about understanding the way the mind works? And it's just like the mind is working fine. The mind is doing just what it does and it's doing it quite fine.
Yeah.
You know, because we misunderstand it, we suffer. If we really could understand how the mind works and just say, well, this is the way it is. You know, it's like when you look outside and you see that it's a sunny day, you don't take the umbrella. Not because, you know, something's wrong with the sun, or if you look outside and it's raining, you decide to take an umbrella. It's because, well, that's the way it is. And so you adapt, you live with conditions the way they are. But it's because you clearly see the way they are that you don't suffer. You don't get wet because you forgot your umbrella. Same with the mind. If you really could understand how the mind works, this is the way it is. Couldn't we just kind of settle in and say, well, this is the way it works. Okay, why struggle with that? We don't have to fix it. We don't have to fix it. You don't have to make the mind. I wouldn't know how to make the mind better if it do its job better, even if I could. I mean, what is it that... and let me ask you this. How much can you actually control your mind anyway?
You
cannot. It's just doing what it's doing.
Yeah.
So all we're doing is observing the mind, just doing what it's doing. But when we see that, oh, this is what the mind's doing, and I suffer, then we can learn to, hopefully, we can learn to let go of that particular suffering. It's not that we change the mind. You know, like change the functioning of the mind somehow, go in there with a scalpel and do some lesions or whatever. It's that through understanding, we stop suffering with the way things are. I think both ways are useful in practice. Sometimes we do want to change the mind. And so we cultivate loving kindness, we cultivate more energy, we cultivate less reactivity, we do work with those qualities of mind. And so there is an intentional changing of the mind. The most important element of that kind of work is the intention. It's not what you do with the mind, it's the fact that there's an intention to do it. Because with that intention usually comes a very strong sense of self. I'm doing this. And either I'm successful or I fail. And it's the I activity of the mind that suffers. So we have to be a little bit careful of I'm doing this. I'm changing the mind. I'm meditating. I'm succeeding. I'm failing. I. Because that's where the suffering is. On the other hand, if we just settle back and just watch the mind go around, it gets happy, it gets fearful, it gets sad, it gets joyful, it thinks, it plans, it does this, it does that. If we could just sit there and watch that go by and not get identified with it as mine, my activity of mind, or my mind, or my-ing, where's the suffering? It's just seeing that it's raining, it's sunny, it's cloudy, it's windy, you know, the leaves are budding, the leaves are falling, the snow is coming, the rain is coming. It's like, well, that's just the way it is. So learning to watch the mind is something like learning to accommodate the weather, the changing weather. Yeah. It's not that we have to fix the weather. We don't have to fix the mind. If we know it, if we observe it and understand it, then we respond appropriately in a way that's less suffering. But it's very easy. In the language of meditation, it's very easy to get caught in an assumption, a belief that I have to fix it. I have to fix, you know, I got to get rid of my kilesas. I got to get rid of my defilements. I got to cultivate my compassion. I have to have more faith. I have to be calmer. I have to be, you know, and when we do all those things, then we really get ourselves tied up in a knot. You know, but if we never had the thought, oh, I'm going to meditate, you wouldn't get the benefit either. So it's a balance, isn't it? You know, having the understanding that, yes, I am going to make the effort, but no, not to emphasize the I, but emphasize the efforting. Yeah. It's kind of tricky. I mean, I think, you know, it's good to expose our beliefs and assumptions, but... not to pick up another one when we expose a wrong one. Yeah.
Can you, just following up on that a little bit, the other part of what I was hearing in this gentleman's comment was the mind and sort of not the body. Can you just talk about the rest of the body and the awareness of that? Because I have found that the body is a very helpful aspect to be aware of, that
sure.
I'm realizing over time how unaware I have been, and just the relationship to the body, I think, changes over time.
Mm-hmm. So the comment is about the role or the place of awareness of body and awareness of mind in the whole spectrum of meditation practice. When we look at this package called a human being, it comes with a body and a mind. Right? You know, that's it. This is the package. This is what we've got this time around. We've got this body and we've got this mind. And for many of us in Western cultural conditioning, for some reason, we get pretty far away from the body. You know, we really get kind of caught up in the mental activity, and we live somewhere just outside the body, just kind of hovering nearby. You know, this is our life, and this thing down here is, well, it's just kind of a thing we got to carry around. And a lot of the initial movement in practice is to stay in touch, is to get in touch with and to stay in touch with the body, because as you know, life is a constant dialogue between the body and mind. There, you know, even though you may think you're pretty out of touch with the body, that out of touchness is talking to the mind all the time, or the mind is talking to that to the body all the time. And for many of us, awareness of body, posture, sensations, feel. Sensation feelings is a good way to get in touch with the mind, right? You know, you can really, you know, if you devote a kind of a steady stream of attention to the body, you'll get in touch with the mind really quite clearly. What we don't want to do is emphasize the awareness of body to the exclusion of mind. You know, there has been a tendency, there have been some teachings and a tendency sometimes to overemphasize the body or to emphasize the body so much that, you know, the mind is struggling and striving and just gritting its teeth in order to be in touch with the body. And we're not even noticing that quality of striving in the mind to do that. So we want to be, you know, sometimes you get the instruction to observe the breath. And many teachers teach observation of the breath. And feeling the belly as it rises and falls, or feeling the sensations at the nostrils as the air enters and leaves the body. And this is a very skillful technique for steadying the mind, for steadying the attention of the mind. But what happens sometimes is we get kind of stuck on the breath, and we devote all of our energy to being with the breath and getting back to the breath as soon as we notice we're off the breath, and not noticing what we're doing to the mind, not noticing the tension in the mind, the, you know, the judgment in the mind, the, you know, the fear of being off the breath in the mind, the, you know, attachment to the technique. So, while the body can be a really good anchor for attention and a good vehicle for becoming aware of the mind, well, it can also be abused, that any technique can be overused or abused and keep you away from the subtlety of the mind. So, it's again, you know, there's kind of a balance there.
You know, I've been sitting here thinking, okay, what's the aspiration? You know, obviously lots of stuff goes through the mind, but what occurs to me is that there's a real contradiction in my practice, because I mean, my aspiration ultimately is to escape from the wheel of samsara, but the technique and everything I learn in practice so far is how attached I am to all the spokes in that wheel of samsara. And when I look at it, there's a part of me that doesn't want to escape from the wheel of samsara, but just enjoy more of the spokes of the wheel of samsara and, you know, not suffer from the icky part of samsara. And I guess what I'm learning is that it's a package deal. And so, but I don't know why I keep coming to meditation retreats, what I'm learning is really how much I'm attached to it all. But, and I don't know, I really don't, when I look, I really don't want to escape, but I keep coming in order to escape. So that's kind of a contradiction.
Oh. It's a good articulation of what there's a certain understanding that we need to get in practice, and that is the difference between the concept of samsara in practice and liberation and the actual reality of how we experience samsara, awareness, liberation. Because we hear teachings, we read books, we hear teachings about practice, about the nature of mind, the activity of mind, the suffering, the path of practice. We read or we hear from teachers these different understandings. But when we take it in, it just is a concept in the mind. It's just an idea we have in the mind. And the mind is very good at creating ideas and creating fantasies. You know, a good writer can describe something so carefully and so succinctly and so wonderfully that it's easy for the mind to just imagine what that thing is. You know, you could describe a fruit. It's shaped like this. It's color like this. It smells like that. It tastes like this. The texture's like that. And you can almost taste it, but not quite. The mind can imagine everything about it except the actual experience of it. And then the actual experience of it is so different than anything that we've imagined. So in practice, we need to hear the teachings, but we have to be careful not to assume that that's what we're going to see in our practice. It's just a way of talking about it. But actually, the taste of an orange is very different than anything anybody could ever tell you about it. Right? Yeah, I can tell you the size, shape, color, the odor, it's just how luscious it is and how juicy it is and that. But you're not going to get any satisfaction from that description. It's only when you taste that orange. And it's really in the tasting of the orange that there is, oh, the real understanding of, oh, this is what it's about. Okay? So we hear the teachings, and we hear the techniques, and we hear about practice, and the path of practice, and the goal of practice, and all that, which really has, well, it's a poor substitute for actual practice and liberation of mind through practice. So I sympathize or empathize with, you know, your understanding of, God, I'm caught in this wheel, samsara, and da-da-da. But the real work is going on the retreat or doing the practice and feeling your attachment, because that's where you can actually let go. Huh? The question that came up for me, though, when you were asking your question or commenting about your relationship to practice is the goal for you in the future, or is it possible to experience the goal in the present? Now, the language you were using sounded like the goal of practice is somewhere off in the future. You know, off the wheel of samsara. You know. I don't know if you've noticed, but we're getting older, Rich. And, you know, the future is getting shorter.
No, I haven't noticed.
Pay more attention. And... You know, the future is just shrinking. Or you might say, the future is just an idea in your mind. It's just a thought in the mind. You know, in I've probably mentioned this before, but at IMS, up in the attic, in the old days, I don't think it's still there, there used to be this big banner that said, the real yogi has no future. What's that mean? You know, well, it means, you know, practice and liberation always happens in the present moment. It's not in the future. It's not in the future. But sometimes we postpone being in this present moment for a future when we'll be free. And that assumption can really get in the way of our being present with what's really going on right now. So I know you're not the only one. I think all of us at different times get caught in, if I do it this way, in the future, it's going to be better. I'm going to be free. I'm going to be more loving. I'm going to be more, you know, less attached. I'm going to be off the wheel of some sort. Whatever, however you imagine the goal, it's going to happen in the future.
Well, but didn't the Buddha, I mean, he, on day one, he said, I want to become free. So he spent 7 years doing all these practices. And after year seven, he was free. And then he, didn't he live a better life for the next 55 years? Well,
yes. And that's one way of understanding it. If that's the only way we understand it, then it's going to be a problem. So yes, we understand that, you know, as I said just earlier, you know, practice is a lifelong thing. It's a lifelong commitment. But it happens only one moment at a time. And it's that moment that, you know, it's in each moment that we can be free in that moment of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, and gradually that can become more of a habit, and the understanding that comes with it can grow in momentum or strength or steadiness of mind, if you will. Yeah.
When we talk about anything, I mean, I'm fairly new in practicing already. There's always this balance between everything. You want to focus on your breath, but you don't want to do it too much. And there's such a fine balance on everything in practice. Well, I live in Yakima, so there's no real chapter or anything there. So
you live what in Yakima? Yakima. Yeah.
Like 2 hours away, so there's no group or anything. So what I'm left with is my own mind, which I don't trust at all, obviously, to make decisions on what, you know, what is that balance? And being new at practicing, I read book after book, and they all contradict, not in fundamentally, but little things.
Yeah.
Well, this one says always focus on this thing and don't switch. Well, this says be open to everything, then I hear you. And it all makes sense, but I'm left to try to distinguish these things, and it's a difficult to find that balance.
Yeah. That you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, this is the challenge for all of us in one form or another, is we hear a range of teachings. They sometimes seem to be very contradictory. And then we look at our own mind, and our own mind doesn't look like any of those teachings. It's like, now what do I do? You know, well, it takes a while to really understand what balance is. And the way we come to understand what balance is we go to the place of imbalance and extreme over and over again. We get too tight, we loosen up, we get too loose. But somewhere in the transition from too tight to too loose, we cross the midpoint. We're balanced. We might not recognize it. It takes a lot of experience. It just takes paying attention over and over and over again to what's going on to begin to refine our understanding of what the balance is for us. A further challenge is what the balance for us is also changing. You know, because, you know, in this set of conditions, we need more energy. And in that set of conditions, we need less energy, or we need more faith or less faith, or more understanding or less understanding, or more determination or less determination. And so it's a total movable feast, if you will. And the way that we come to really understand balance is from paying attention to our own experience. And when you recognize, wow, I'm really out of balance, you know, I'm trying too hard, or I'm too lax, or whatever, then we make an adjustment. Make an adjustment, and that will in that moment bring us back to balance, or attempt to move us back to balance. There's a story or an image I use that speaks to this. You know the space shuttle that they send up from Florida? They take this space shuttle, they send it up from Florida, they got the computers on board, they got the program of, you know, the map of how to get to the space station up there. And, you know, it goes up and the computers make the adjustments and it circles around, and a couple days later it arrives at the space station. Right? Now this is a little thing on Earth. Earth, little thing, is a littler thing way up there, and it eventually gets there. I've heard that 98% of the time, the space shuttle is off course. Off course. Out of balance. And yet, it still gets there. Why? It gets there because as soon as the computers on board recognize it's off course, or the groundskeepers or whatever they are recognize it's off course, they make a mid-course correction and bring it kind of back on track. A little bit back, a little bit more closer to the direction they need to be going. But of course they overshoot, and you know, once they recognize, oh, we're off track again, they make another mid-course correction, and you know, and eventually they get there. Well, you know, our practice is not so different. We're aiming for, well, liberation or freedom or awareness or the present moment, and we're off course about 98% of the time. You know, we're just not doing it right. You know, we're trying too hard, we're not trying hard enough, we got too much faith, too much, whatever. And yet, if you keep doing that and making the mid-course corrections when you see that you're out of balance, you will get there. You'll get there. What's difficult for us to accept is that we're wrong so much of the time. You know, and it's that judgment, that evaluation and judgment that undermines and weakens our resolve and our commitment and our faith that this practice is actually working. So I applaud your effort to find balance, and I know it's not easy. But with more experience, you'll realize out of all these experiences, these are the extremes on the right, these are the extremes on the left, these are the extremes at the top, these are the extremes at the bottom, and somewhere in the middle is balance. Yeah. Last comment? Yeah, Paulette?
In the last year or so, is a new carrot for my practice.
A new carrot for your practice.
And that is the possibility of wisdom and understanding.
Yeah.
And the idea that I could see, that I could understand and see in each moment the principles of the Dharma and be really interested in each moment. And I think that from the beginning of practice, there's always been a desire to be more interested in life in a way.
Uh-huh.
And it started out by started out with this idea that maybe I could experience a non-ordinary type of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's more like, well, maybe ordinary reality could be really riveting, you know, if you're in that zone.
Mm.
And so so that's my new motivation, and I know that it's still pretty conceptual in a way, and there's an excitement like that it could be that interesting and wonderful a feeling all the time is probably silly. But
yeah.
But that's really the point.
Yeah, but for you now having. You know, really understanding or seeking understanding and believing that understanding can be that exciting, even of ordinary reality, is the hook, let's say, that keeps you interested in looking. I think that you know, understanding is the key to liberation, you know. But where does this understanding come from? It doesn't come from thinking. And it doesn't come from books. It comes from observation. You know, just really observing what's going on in your life and then understanding deeply, well, how do you understand this? What is this all about? And then when we understand correctly, then we move our life into alignment with the way things are rather than struggle with the way things are. Yeah, more freedom. I think at different times in our practice and different times in our life or different times in our practice that there's different motivating energy. Sometimes it's just a tremendous amount of faith. Sometimes it's just a tremendous amount of energy. Sometimes it's a tremendous curiosity. Sometimes it's the unfolding of wisdom. And it changes by itself. You know, our the field of our interest just changes. You know, and sometimes the hardest part is in the transition when what used to work no longer works for you, but you haven't yet found a new juice in practice. and we can think, oh, it's flat, it's not working, it's over, I'm going to go do something else with life. It's hard to kind of sustain attention through periods of disinterest or no interest. Yeah.